Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is called Zingaya. It is by Zingaya, and it's called Nomad's Land. You know, it always reminds me of riding a camel across the sand dunes of Egypt. Can you just imagine that sort of loping gait of the camel? Yeah, that's what it feels like to me. It sort of transports me to that that sort of place. Well, I have some breaking news for you. I am ecstatic to announce that I have coming on the show in June the famous Noam Chomsky, a great mind indeed, who I will have the honor of chatting with, and I have to admit I'm very nervous. We'll talk about how language can be used to oppress. Many of you probably know some things about that. We'll certainly discuss politics. I will try to delve into how closely aligned his views are with a non-dominator society like goddess ideals. I suspect we are probably all under the same big tent, but I am so thrilled. I feel like this is a major coup. So please listen for that show in early June. I think it's June 5th or 6th. And I haven't had a lot of time to advertise the last two shows, so I want to make sure I mention last week I had Michael Horowitz and Cynthia Palmer on the show talking about their book, Sisters of the Extreme, Women Writing on the Drug Experience. And it was so interesting because they documented experiences of writers like Charlotte Bronte, Louisa May Alcott, Maya Angelou, Carrie Fisher, and other equally interesting women and their experiences using hallucinogens, both with very good results and some with very bad. So you might want to listen to that show. We've been delving into the subject of sacred hallucinogens from many different angles. It's like an like an onion with lots of different layers. And Monday of this week, I had a special show. Deborah Heenigan talked about connecting with spirits on the other side and dealing with grief of a loved one who passes on. We got lots of callers, and you might want to take a listen. And after Deborah, Sally Kempton talked about awakening Shakti and the power of the yoga goddesses. That was a really fun conversation. But turning my attention to tonight, these two guys are awesome too. They come under the category of guys who get it, and I can't wait for our chat. First up tonight, although he hasn't called in yet and he has me a little bit nervous, is Carl McColeman. He's going to discuss Julian of Norwich, a Christian mystic from around the time of 1371, and the hidden dimension of goddess within Christianity. Then afterwards, Andrew Gurevich discussing Gaian interconnectivity and the future of public myth. That one might have you scratching your head, but we will get into topics like that Paleolithic goddess imagery of the Chauvet Cave from that movie Cave of Forgotten Dreams. Really interesting stuff. We'll chat about the violent origins of patriarchal religion, Columbia and the history of the American goddess. A very sweeping topic for sure. So grab a cup of tea, settle in, and get comfortable. And Andrew, if by any chance you are listening and Carl doesn't call in the next 5 or 10 minutes here, I would really appreciate it if you call in early. Okay? But just a couple more things before we get to this dynamic duo. First, a word from Joe Carson and Dancing with Gaia.
The psychic state of the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and divine were all connected, they were together, that there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
That was some of the sounds from the trailer for Dancing with Gaia, a feature documentary about Earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of the goddesses Gaia. It's a sincere film that goes deep into the connection between these important topics. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini-book that expands on the material of the film, and you can get it at dancingwithgaia.com. And I do recommend it, listeners. I have seen it, and it's really good. It's one of those things that you definitely want to have in your library. Now, I think we might have Carl on the line. I'm just going to go in and see if that's him. Hold on just one sec while I unmute my caller. Hi, Carl, is that you?
This is Andy Gervich, actually.
Oh, hey, thank you for calling in. Carl had a problem, and I thought he was going to be calling in. His daughter was rushed to the emergency room. And he said he was going to be available, but thank you for getting to me early. You know, that's awesome. I'm glad that you were listening and could fill in, because I have my doubts if he's actually going to be able to make it. Maybe things took a turn for the worse. But anyway,
yeah.
Listeners, we have our second guest with us. He's up first, and, you know, everything happens for a reason. I wondered how we were going to squeeze everything we were going to talk about into an hour. So, you know, we'll make lemonade out of lemons here, Andrew.
Absolutely.
So let me start. I'm a little bit disorganized now, but
I am too. I thought I had another hour to prepare, but that's, we'll do it together.
Well, let me. Well, thank you for being flexible. But let me start by telling listeners about you a little bit from your bio. I want your listeners to know about you, because I'm really impressed with your work. So, listeners, this is Professor Andrew Gervich. He lives with his wife in Portland, Oregon. He has two kids and teaches religion, literature, and philosophy. While finishing an MA in Judeo-Christian history and biblical theology, he had a series of transformative experiences that led him to renounce the fundamentalism of the modern patriarchal religions and embrace a path of discovery in the archaic integrative wisdom traditions. After a second MA in English literature, he began to integrate his training in literature, philosophy, and theology to explore the ancient mythic structures that underscore our modern social systems and philosophical paradigms. His desire to discover and connect with the sacred feminine began early in life due to a troubled relationship with his own mother, and has led him to research the goddess archetype in the earliest human religion traditions dating back some 600,000 years. His work has appeared in Popular Archaeology, The Ecologist, The Voice, Reality Sandwich, Evolver.net, Current,
D-Theater.com. Digital Theater, yeah.
Okay, thank you. As well as
sure.
In the book, The Afterlife Survey, he's written and lectured about the mythos, psychological pillars of the climate change denial movement, epigenetics, neuropsychology, and religious symbolism, goddess mythology in the United States and in old Europe, and the resurgence of the sacred feminine in the mystic traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. He's currently writing a book about the Native American myth of the Spider Woman and its mythological and cultural implications for modern society. So, Andrew, I have to tell you, it thrills me when a guy like you so obviously gets it. We need so many more of you. We got to figure out a way to clone you.
Well, I don't know about that, but thank you so much. It's an absolute delight to talk to you finally.
Well, and thank you for coming on the show. It, you know, I found you, I think, by way of your article in Reality Sandwich, the article
mm-hmm.
titled "In Goddess We Trust: America's Spiritual Crossroads." And as I read it, I felt like you were me. You know, I mean, all of these things you've been talking about, I have been going on and on and on about, and it seemed like to me. It felt like, oh, thank goddess, other people are getting this too. You know, I'm not alone here beating my head against a brick wall. And then you sent me your other paper on forgotten wisdom of the, is it Chauvet Cave?
Yeah, Chauvet, yeah.
Chauvet Cave in France, that was based on that wonderful documentary, Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And I got to tell you, after I read that paper, I thought, man, you know, I wish that that film had been based on your paper and had really got to delve into all of the things you brought out, all the, you know, the connections, you know, how the cave really proved in your mind, I mean, you made a wonderful case that it proved that goddess spirituality was going on way back then.
Boy, so many places to start. You know, I something came to mind before we talked about the cave when you mentioned, you know, reading the Columbia article. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about my entering into goddess scholarship and goddess study.
Yeah, I think that's really important, too. It gives a lot of context. And, you know, since Carl hasn't called, I think we're going to have a lot of time now. So,
okay, sure.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with your fundamentalist background, and then we'll jump into the other subjects, or what?
Sure. Well, let me just respond to one thing you just said that I really found interesting, and that's that, you know, you read the piece and then thought, oh, my goodness, I've been saying these things for years. You know, that's something that I really tried to stay sensitive to in my work coming into this. And to give proper attribution, you know, I was speaking with a friend the other day, and she said, you know, it's funny, anytime a man starts talking to me about the goddess, I normally break out in a rash.
Why?
And,
why did she? As a good thing
ahead.
Or a bad thing?
Well, you know, a skeptical thing originally, and I think there's two reasons, and as I've been doing this work already, I really see this pop up. One is that men, even well-intended men, can sometimes come into conversations like this and be a little dominant and a little domineering, and we get excited and we have ideas, and we haven't been, in many cases, living these actual truths and actually having to live this oppression firsthand. And so, you know, we can come to it from kind of outsider perspective and miss something, I think, in the full experience of what it means to have a conversation. And so I think sometimes a lot of women feel slighted by men that come in to the, I mean, we need men, and we need men to be supportive, and we need men engaged, but I think we also have to do a lot of listening.
Yeah.
You know, when you had Danica Anderson on, and she kept talking about, you know, the power of women's stories, and how transformation is really going to come out of that. You know, I think that a lot of people in my position aren't sensitive enough to listen to the women we're working with and really listen to their stories and listen to their experience, and to the fact that, exactly as you said, a lot of women have been saying these things for years. You know, a friend of mine recently said, it's so frustrating. When I read your article, I thought, you know, she said, I'll sit with my husband and tell him an idea sometimes, and he goes, and kind of blows it off. And then a male friend of his will say the same thing, and he'll say, that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and
women
says,
say that all the time. If it comes from a man, somehow it's mm-hmm. taken as being more credible than if it comes from a woman, it's somehow diminished.
Absolutely. You know, and I noticed that with Charles Eisenstein's book on sacred economics. You know, Rian Eisler or even Genevieve Vaughn have been writing about gift economies for a couple of decades now.
Right, and all of which I've had on the show.
Right, absolutely.
Well, and, you know, but what you say is true. And, you know, and I want to, you know, honor both sides. Yes, men mm-hmm. do have to listen, but women have to kind of get over it, too, you know.
Yeah.
They need men on their side. They have to grow a little bit thicker skin. And mm-hmm. And I think they need to find a little bit of their masculine to be able to sort of just, you know, to stand next to a guy shoulder to shoulder and not feel like he's competing with her, that he's still trying to oppress her, but he's really trying to help her. And, you
right.
know, I saw that firsthand with one of my, you know, one of the guests who comes on my show, you know, semi-regularly when he's got a new mm-hmm. book, David Hillman. He is mm-hmm. a wonderful scholar who he has made some, not, you know, some feminists crazy. They are angry with him because he is saying, look, feminist scholars, you are missing stuff out there about powerful women of ancient times. Here I'm pointing where to look so you can hold these women up, you know, and make your case. But you know what? Because it came from a man, I really believe it was hard for them to take that, you know. They didn't realize he was on their side. So sometimes, you know, we women got to get our shit together too, you know.
Yeah, you know, I can appreciate that. And I think that message comes, you know, a lot better from somebody like yourself than it does me. I think, you know, there as a man, there just needs to be a sensitivity to the fact that, you know, I represent on some level through my person, through my physicality, through my voice, that system of oppression that got us to this point. And, you know, I think saying to women, for me to say to women, hey, you have to get beyond this is a sensitive issue. You know, it's a sensitive issue because I think a lot of men, the other thing that comes up, and I see this frequently, is that we still live in this kind of guru culture. And a lot of men start talking about the goddess, and they really only talk about it in terms of, you know, pertaining to women as objects still. The term goddess to a lot of men, they really strip it of a lot of its power, a lot of its ancient power, and really still refer to women as goddesses only when they're kind of coming on to them. You know, I think
in a sexual manner.
Well.
Yeah, it's like, you know, maybe, you know, they know Aphrodite, but that's about it.
Yeah, right. And we've restripped the, you know, her of her life-giving and death-bringing capacities, and so she's a sex goddess only, but then furthermore, in a patriarchal context, she's not even a sexual goddess, but a sexual object.
Well,
still there,
you know,
for men's.
Well, you know, I think we're talking about so many different issues. You know, first of all, we're all so wounded, and we're trying to carve a path, as I like to say sometimes, with our pink-handled machetes.
Yeah.
But we don't really have role models. You know, we don't all know how to do it. I mean, I get in trouble because I'm not an angry enough feminist sometimes. I'm not angry enough at men. But you know what? Coming through the goddess community, I think this happened for a reason. I had more issues with women than I have with men. And in a way, I think that happened so my eyes would stay open to men are not always the enemy, you know?
Yeah, and more of us are waking up, and we're doing it because of a lot of patience and a lot of openness on the part of people like you. If I hadn't been able to, you know, have conversations with Susanna Budapest, if I hadn't been able to, you know, to be in contact with a lot of these people, you know, Danica Anderson and a lot of these folks, and learn from them in real time, I wouldn't have been coming to a lot of the conclusions that I did.
Yeah.
And so it's been because of a lot of really patient and open women. I just think it's, you know, I learned a phrase today, a savior industrial complex.
Say it again? What was it?
Savior industrial complex, this idea that, you know, there's a resentment among some feminists or of any marginalized community. This happens, you know, in indigenous communities as well, where some well-intended white person comes in, or man in the feminist sense, to sort of sweep in and save the day. And there's a kind of gratitude, as you said, that, okay, here's a person who's an ally, here's a person who gets it. But then there's a skepticism to say, well, you represent the group that took our power in the first place, and so now you're here to give it back. And there's a bit of resentment there because, you know what I mean, because of the whole notion of perpetual victimization reasserts itself in that dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, you're making me think about there were some white writers who sort of co-opted Native American spirituality, and I'm thinking that reminds me of that as well. And, you know, I think another problem is, like when you were talking about men who talk about goddess but only know about her from maybe the sensuality or sexuality aspect. I tell women all the time who don't want to do ritual with men, who don't want to teach men, how do you ever expect them to get it unless you teach them better, you know?
Yeah, that's really true.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's an education element, I think, to this as well. You know, we don't have a really good foundation across the board of solid teaching out there to learn about this stuff. Because, you know, men aren't going to sign up for women's studies classes.
Right.
And more and more
that.
Colleges don't even have women's studies classes.
And, right. They're gender studies now. And men, and, you know, we're starting to really get more aware of how patriarchy has affected men as well.
Yeah.
How it's laid down a code of rules for our gender. And not to, you know, I'm not coming at this from a men are victims too. You know, but more from the standpoint of, you know, we really have to understand that we have to make a new masculinity, and one that's rooted in cooperation, not ownership, not competition, not greed, not power over another, but power with.
Rules. Yeah, and some people have talked about the new male archetype is the protector, you know, the protector of the feminine, the protector of life, you know, rather than, you know, the aggressor, you know, the dominator. So and men, I feel sorry for men sometimes too, because, you know, they're stuck in this narrow little box of what society and culture and religion tells them they're supposed to be. And I'm sure there are a lot of men that didn't feel comfortable in that box either, even though they might not have been oppressed. They couldn't be their authentic selves any more than women could be their authentic selves.
I'm reminded, this reminds me of a line, boy, we're bouncing all over the place, but this reminds me of a line from George Orwell, actually, when he's talking about white dominion in the East, in the Far East, and when he was a police officer there in his younger life. He says, when the white man turns tyrant, it's his own freedom he destroys.
Yes. Yes,
because he's no longer free.
Yeah.
Be the tyrant. He has to live as the oppressor from there forward.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great opening here, Andrew. I'm glad we're going to have a lot of time tonight because, you know, the topics we were going to talk about are big. Each one
yes.
could have been a whole show. So do you want to start with how you started out as a fundamentalist evangelical Christian pastor and now,
yes.
like me, I feel like, you know, I came from the Bible Belt of New Orleans and look where I am. You know, who'd have thunk
right.
it, you know?
The fruit has fallen far from the tree in both cases, huh? Fortunately. Well, yeah, you know, that's a fascinating question. I started as an evangelical in my late teens. I came from a very, as you mentioned in the opening, I came from a very complicated family dynamic that was responsible for both of the sort of decisions in terms of my religious background. As a child, I kind of always was interested in matters of spirit and myth and metaphor because of my own family. My dad was in the mafia. He was married 5 times. He was a very abusive man, a lot of guns in our house. And my mother and my mother was his last wife. We moved around the country a lot every couple of years because of his work. And so I grew up not very rooted to any sense of place and not very connected to my family. And because I moved so much, I didn't have a lot of friends. And because my relationship with my parents and my older siblings was really tough, I was a strange kid. I stayed in my room a lot. I started putting on weight. And so I was really kind of isolated from what was going on around me. And I always really wondered, what are the deep things that caused my family to be this way? How did we get like this? Why do my parents make the choices they make? What's going on deep in them, that brings us to where we are as this family? My mother was I'll speak more about her in a minute, but this had me from a very early age interested in myth and metaphor and religion and spirituality. I grew up as a secular Jew, not in any type of religious home whatsoever. And when I graduated from high school and moved out on my own, I moved to Portland, Oregon, started going to school, and met a girl. We got married in my early 20s, and I had kids. And suddenly realized that I had absolutely no idea how to be a parent or a husband. You know, I did not learn any of these things from my family.
Right.
And I was terrified because I thought, what do? I have to know how to do this. I have to know how to be in this family now.
And you probably didn't want to duplicate what you saw as a kid.
Did not want to duplicate what I saw. My father would, like I said, would chase us around the house with guns. He was very verbally abusive. He was a really, really angry man. And my mother was, and this figures into the change into the study of the goddess. She was, her mother died giving birth to her. She was the daughter of an abusive alcoholic father who died when she was like, also died when she was like 6 or 7. And so back in the 40s in New York, she went into the orphanage, into the Catholic orphanage, where she was beaten and sexually assaulted by the priests and nuns for her entire childhood.
Mm.
Left when she was adopted by a family in New York when she, a couple of years later when she was, 13 or so, and then was sexually assaulted by the father of that family.
Wow.
Until she turned 18, at which time she left, joined the military. She became a nurse in the Air Force and got out of the Air Force and was working as a nurse and slash prison guard at Rikers Island Prison in New York. Very, very tough woman. Very powerful woman in a lot of ways. Because of what she had to survive through.
Right.
And then met my father when he was actually an inmate at the prison, right? And they fell in love and got married. And,
interesting.
Yeah.
There's a book right there. Your mother could have wrote a book.
It was a fascinating story in a lot of ways. But she, you know, it took me a very long time to realize this, but, you know, she wasn't a very nurturing or loving person and didn't really connect that well with me. She would tell me, well, let me back up. Okay, so, you know, with my family, so here I am in Portland, and I'm looking around for something to connect to give me a community that has purpose, that has momentum, that could provide me with a skill set to help raise my family. And I had some friends who went to church, and they invited me along. And you know how that is. There's a presentation that they really have all of that to offer you, that here is mm-hmm. this entire community, and they're going to welcome you in, and you're going to be embraced, and you're going to have kids too, and there's, you know, you're going to be okay because there's this larger entity to plug into.
Yeah.
And so that's where it started for me. But then, you know, so we started attending church, and I started, you know, I felt like I had some kind of dynamic then to participate in. And then I went to school, and because of my interest in religion, I thought, well, okay, I'm a Christian, I'm going to church, let me, I might as well go to Bible college and seminary. And pursued that, and almost immediately I started to realize that I was in the wrong place. But it takes a while to really come to terms with that. You know, for years I kind of was walking around with this, did I leave the iron on? Or, you know what I mean? I just had this sense of...
Well, you had an investment, and you probably didn't know where else to go.
Nowhere else to go. Yeah, I had absolutely no idea where else to go.
Yeah.
But it started over things like the social issues. You know, something would come up. So I finished school, finished graduate school, and then started working in the ministry as a working pastor. And, you know, some issue would come up over, you know, reproductive rights or same-sex marriage or, you know, the teaching of evolution or stem cells, you know, just name the thing, some sort of social issue. And I would think about it, pray about it, and say, I come down on this side, on the side of compassion, on the side of advocating for humanity. And my church would always say, wrong. No, you have to come down on this side.
Right.
Emphasizing, you know, faithfulness and obedience over compassion, love, and equanimity.
Right.
So that started to drive a wedge between myself and the church, because it was on every single social issue this came up. And then I started exploring the theology more. And started seeing all of the stuff, you know, I was, again, in prepping for our conversation, I was looking back over, listening back to some of your earlier shows and listened to the one with Barbara Walker, who's just a hero of mine, and a lot of the stuff she was talking about, you know, out of the book of Deuteronomy and Deuteronomy 22, where God says, if a man comes into your town and lies with a young woman and rapes a young woman, and that woman has been promised to another man, then the punishment is death. For the man, actually for both of them. If the woman hasn't been promised to another man, then he can pay the father, you know, 30 pieces of silver and take the girl as his lifelong sex slave at that point.
And that still goes on today. I mean, you know, Nicholas Kristof in his book Half the Sky, you know, mm-hmm. pointed that out. You know, rapists can get away with the rape by just marrying their victim.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is in the covenant. This is in, you know, this is with Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament, ratifying his covenant with his people. And I found that to be, you know, obviously kind of troubling when I would point this out to people and they would kind of look at you with this blank stare or give you this kind of, oh, well, that was the Old Testament and things are different now. But two things, as you said, they're not actually that different now. And also any system or any deity that ever would have said that this was okay behavior, I just said I'm absolutely not okay with this. You know, and there are so many other places in the Bible where rape is condoned.
Right.
An esoteric one is in the book of Job. At the end of the book of Job, when you know the story, so here's this man who's not done anything wrong at all, but God and the devil make a bet to see if they can get him to curse God. So they give him diseases, they destroy his family, they kill all of his children. And he's out basically cursing himself, you know, sitting on the trash heap waiting to die. And he basically just asks God why this happens to him. And God shows up and gives him this lengthy poetic answer that is actually the last several chapters of Job 38 and following, some of the oldest, if not the oldest, bit of scripture ever written. And so it's a very early, the story of Job isn't, but this poetry section is, and they just added it to this book later. And God says some very interesting things in this section. He says, I was the one who bound up the sacred waters. right? And that's fascinating because Yahweh, when he starts talking, he always says, I'm the one who creates things. He's very insistent on this, right? It's almost mm-hmm. as if he's trying to convince you that it's he who is the creator, not don't look behind the curtain.
Right, yeah. It's like he protests too much, you know, that
expression. He protests too much. And then he says, I'm the one who loosened Orion's belt. And that's such a disturbing sentence to me because this is referring to the myth of Orion and the Pleiades. And in one of the versions of this myth, Orion tries to rape the Pleiades. And Zeus has to protect them by throwing them up into the sky as the seven stars, the seven sisters.
Yeah.
And Yahweh says, I'm the one who dropped his pants for him. I mean, that's in the Bible.
Wow. I hadn't heard these things. Well, mm-hmm. You know, I've always thought that, you know, the God of the Old Testament, you know, he was the sociopath that mm-hmm. you wouldn't, I mean, look, he was into, you know, well, like all of this oppression of women, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, it was okay for Moses to come down after getting the Ten Commandments and, you know, and kill off that tribe that didn't, you know, want to go along. He was into sacrificing sons. I mean, you wouldn't want this guy for a brother or a husband
yeah.
or a neighbor.
Or a neighbor,
but you want him for a god? Come on, you know, use some critical thinking, please.
Yeah, and right off the bat, you know, Abraham, I've talked with some people about this, you know, Abraham leaves one of his sons in the desert to die and tries to assassinate the other. And here's the founder of, you know, and so this is also extremely problematic. You're absolutely correct. And in fact, you know, when Moses comes down from the mountaintop with the commandments, and the people are worshiping the golden calf, the reason he was so angry at that was because, you know, many scholars suggest that this golden calf is some manifestation of Isis.
Oh, or Hathor,
so
I was thinking, maybe, you know.
Yeah, and so the people are re-embracing the sacred feminine because this is a natural thing for us. This is something the patriarchal religions still struggle with, is that these archetypes, these mother and father archetypes that we all possess are deep within our subconscious, and our mythologies are about emergence. And as such, they really have to deal with both of these energies, right? And when we have a patriarchy that rejects the one, to elevate the other, we have a culture that becomes imbalanced,
right.
becomes disconnected from its mythological world.
Right.
But going back to the thing with my family, if you don't mind, when I was married and when I was in the church, I mean, the things that I was learning in the church were only reinforcing a lot of the brokenness and anger I had, you know. So in the church, you know, in the Christian story, right, why is there sin and death and suffering in the world? Eve's fault, right? It wasn't for that damn Eve. That woman did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in my life, subconsciously, I had the same thing. My relationship with both of my parents was strange, but my relationship with my mother was extremely complicated. She would tell me from the time, you know, I was 5 years old, she would say, I can remember this clear as day, I'd be sitting at the table eating, you know, my cereal or whatever, and she would say, I had 5 miscarriages before I had you. God was trying to tell me something, and I should have listened to him.
Oh.
And I didn't even know what a miscarriage was. I mean, I was 5 years old. It took me years to even. I mean, I knew she was saying something mean, but I didn't quite get it.
Right.
So my mother's, and the funny thing about that is I think she was right. My mother's body was trying to reject me from the before I was even a person. Because I think something in her body, I think her wisdom body understood probably that she wasn't supposed to be a mother because of all the things that happened to her were going to make her not a very nurturing person.
Right. I feel so sorry for women of her time. I mean, my mother's relationship with my mother was very complicated too. It was a rather cold relationship. And
mm-hmm.
sometimes I think those of us who have not had loving relationships with our mothers are drawn to the goddess maybe more. But I feel sorry for women like your mother and my mother. They had so few choices. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Just a lifetime of abuse, including when she met my father. I mean, it just continued. You know, I mean, she never had a safe place on this earth. And that's, you know, when I finally got through that, when I finally was able to start working through that. So, you know, in the story, I mean, this dovetailed in a horrible way with my own brokenness, because if I'm living in a system that is, you know, reinforcing this idea of masculine assertion and masculine power over, right? The Bible is very clear that the husband is the head of the family. The husband has power over. And is a system that says all sin and suffering and death in the world is the fault of the woman. dovetailed very, very well into my own brokenness and fear and my own inner misogyny, right? And so my first marriage ended because my first wife and I fought all the time, right? Because I was a very angry and scared person as well, and I was there. I was heading towards recreating the same thing that my father was.
Right.
Right. There's the anger. There's the rage. There's the confusion. What's going on? I don't know. This woman did it to me, right? The fear and all of that stuff is just bubbling up, right? And so when my marriage ended, two things happened. And both of them ended up being good. It helped me realize that I needed to leave the church because I realized I'm really not supposed to be here. I've just been staying around because now it's my career, but I don't really have this faith anymore. And I probably never really did, not in the same way that many of the people from the system do. And then secondarily, I have to get to work on finding out, getting in touch with this brokenness inside of me and what it is. And so I went to therapy, a wonderful woman counselor. I chose a woman counselor on purpose because I really wanted to address this with somebody that I could be vulnerable with and take wisdom from, who's female. And was able to, with her, have a conversation with her that I was never able to have with my mother. My mother died recently and left me out of her. I was her only child and left me out of her obituary. It was,
wow.
I mean, from start to finish, it was a really cold thing. But in that conversation, I was able to do a couple of things. I was able to get in touch with the mother archetype that actually is in all of us. And, you know, to go psychobabble for a second, use it to nurture that inner child in me that never had access to that.
Right.
And then I thought, whoa, if I can do that, if I can access that power with my brokenness and my background, then that power is there for everybody. That's available to all of us. But what is this, right? What is this thing that I just accessed that is providing all of this healing, providing all of this connectivity, providing all of this understanding? Because the second thing it did was it helped me forgive my mother because of the very thing you just said a second ago. This woman had so few choices and so few options in her life, and was broken. You know, my anger shifted from being angry at her for not being the mother that I hoped she would be,
mm-hmm.
being angry with the society for breaking her the way it did.
Oh, right? I can so relate to that.
What the patriarchy did to her, and I went, wow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I still have my moments when I get mad at my mother, and I have to, you know, I have to remind myself, you know, let the, you know, be the adult and not the child, and remember what her suffering was like, and not just say she didn't give me everything I wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and you know where the leap that my brain is taking here, as you talk about your, you know, your background and you know, you were almost a minister or did you actually become a minister? Did you go all
yes.
the way?
All the way. I was a working preaching pastor.
Would it, you know, I as I'm thinking that, I'm drawing the parallel to what's going on in our country. You know,
mm-hmm.
how our Christian nation, who is always so ready to go to war, our
yeah.
Christian nation who has no empathy, and I hate to say it because I know lots of really wonderful Christians who don't
yeah.
adhere to these kinds of ideas, but so many of them do, you know. It's like Christianity in the Bible gives them license to be this dominator, this dominator culture. And
yeah.
it scares me to death, you know. It's like, how do we shift away from that? Because, you know, if God says you can do it, then, you know, you can justify anything.
You can justify anything. I tell you, you're absolutely onto something there. And, you know, I was looking forward to listening to your first guest because I have a little bit of background in Christian mysticism and Jewish mysticism as well. And you know, it's amazing in these patriarchal religions, as much as they try to assert themselves and dominate, as much as they try to push this masculine archetype, as much as they really reinforce ego and ownership and violence as the sort of pillars of the system. I mean, Yahweh is the absolute manifestation of pure ego. When he says his name, he says, I am.
Mm-hmm.
He's just pure, unadulterated, unfiltered ego.
Yeah.
Unfiltered, unchecked aggression. And he says he's jealous, he's rageful. He'll, you, if you look at what he tells you not to look at, he'll turn you into a pillar of salt. I mean, he's sociopathic.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't want to fear my God, you know?
Yeah.
I want to have respect for my God, but I don't want him to be like my, you know, my alcoholic father that I never knew what mood he was going to be in when I came home from school.
Right. And I'll tell you, you know, the goddess, and this is something that, you know, I just came back from a conference in New Orleans, and there's a real misnomer with the goddess archetype, as if, you know, the god is a strong, powerful, you know, fearsome entity, and the goddess is always this soft, nurturing, loving thing. And again, you always say, want to bet? Have you seen Mother Kali?
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the ocean? Have you seen, you know, Earth
right.
the Major? Artemis, that the, you know, the goddess is fierce in a capacity as well, but that ferocity is always a protective energy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
It's a ferocity in service of protecting the tribe, protecting the community, protecting the biosphere. And yes, the ocean can rise up and swallow us up. It can be and is a terrible thing. But it's not angry with you when it does that. It's not mad because you didn't call it the right name. It's not mad because you're a man and you love another man.
Yeah, it's not about
you know
ego.
What I mean?
Yeah,
right, it's not about ego, and it's not about punishment. It's about cycles of life, death, destruction, and regeneration. And,
right.
And when we get ourselves into that pull, when we get ourselves into that flow, it just changes our perception entirely. But in these religions, you know, to the extent that they try to push this, they really try to lock it down and control women and control this whole notion of the sacred feminine, you still see the goddess popping up. You know, you still see this feminine energy emerging through them. And, you know, I'm thinking of a few things in Judaism in particular. You know, the fact that they call themselves Hebrews I don't know if you're aware of this, but this is one of those things where does this word come from? And one tradition says that it goes back to Abraham's grandfather, whose name was Eber, and so they just take the patriarchal aspect back one generation or two, I guess, to the source of the family line. But the other thing says no, when they were in Egypt, they became devotees of the goddess Kiba, and stuck with this. And this is why they're worshiping the calf in the desert. This is why when they first, in the pre-exilic period, up until about 600 BC. Most Israelite families worshipped a goddess named Ashtaroth more than they worshipped Yahweh.
Yeah.
Absolutely true. And in fact, their priests were originally called Levites, priests of the Leviathan, literally of the sea serpent. Right?
So
which is,
are we talking like Tiamat?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Tiamat and her serpent. Yeah, absolutely. This is the same mythology.
Yeah.
So even in that, and then when we go into Christian mythology, right, and we have all of the misogyny and all of the hatred and all of the oppression of women, but by 1000 AD, or even a little bit earlier in Rome, not only do we have a functioning Isis cult, but it is so influential that the cult of Mary starts at the same time period. And then we have the rise of Christian mystics, Julian of Norwich, Meister Eckhart, you know, all these people that are getting back in touch with this feminine side of God, this mothering aspect. This
yeah, probably aspect. Probably Hildegard von Bingen. And
Hildegard, yeah, this notion of connectivity. And you know, I think what's really going on here is, among other things, is that there, you know, there's some brand new research from being done by some people. Wonderful. I'd love to have you have Jill Bolte Taylor on your show sometime.
Who?
Jill Bolte Taylor.
Okay.
Her? She did that wonderful TED talk called The Stroke of Insight. She's the neuroscientist who had a stroke and was able to kind of study her own brain from the inside while she was having the stroke.
Yes.
And she made some phenomenal observations. Plugging my phone in. Hang on. Plug my phone in, sorry. She made some amazing observations about how the hemispheres of the brain work. And her work's been, you know, there's some other folks, Ian McGilchrist in his book on the divided brain, Jeremy Rifkin, there's several others. This whole thing about hemispheric science, it took off in the 60s. And then people started saying these things like, okay, the left hemisphere controls reason, the right hemisphere controls emotion. The left hemisphere does this, the right does that. And we kind of oversimplified it a little bit. little bit. And so people kind of stepped away from it and said, okay, we're not really sure what's going on with the hemispheres, and so we'll get back to it, right? And over the past 10 years, neuropsychologists and neuroanatomists have gotten back to it. And what they've found quickly is that the right hemisphere of the brain emphasizes states of connectivity and interconnectivity. It works as like a parallel processor in a computer. Whereas the left emphasizes individuation, separateness, categorization, and distinction. The left thinks in about the past, it thinks about the future, and it thinks primarily in language, and it thinks in terms of I am, right? When I'm thinking with my left hemisphere, I become a separate individual from the world around me, separate from you, separate from the energetic flow that inhabits all things. When I'm
dare
thinking
I say,
in my right
sounds just like Republicans.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, because they're left hemisphere dominant. Absolutely, and just like Christians of the kind we've been speaking about as well. Whereas right hemispheric states emphasize connectivity, emphasize a larger, what I've been calling this Gaian interconnectivity, the topic of my talk tonight, this awareness through the senses of one's energetic connection to the entire cosmos, right? And filling one with this sense of balance and equanimity and harmony with all that is living, right? And this is a right hemispheric way of thinking.
Right.
And my work is centered around trying to bring these findings of neuropsychology into the study of religion. Because what I've been suggesting is that what I see the goddess as, among other things, is a manifestation of our right hemisphere's creative property. As this ability to guide human beings out of these selfish states, what the Buddhists call tana, this desire for private personal fulfillment, and into these states of connectivity. As you said, we become a country that has no empathy.
Right.
And I think the goddess beckons us towards, you know, evolving from this Homo sapien, this knowledge-based creature, to Homo empathicus, which is an empathetic and empathic creature.
Yeah, because somehow the left, the conservatives or the left brain-oriented people, mm-hmm. when you share, when you say you want to share and care and have compassion and empathy, I don't know if it scares them or they
mm-hmm.
just, they think that's weakness. They think
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
Foolishness. You know, I mean, just like the whole idea, if you're poor, well, you must not have worked hard, you know,
as
if the playing field out there is level and everybody has the same breaks and opportunities, you know. Well, you know, you had something in your article. There was a word you used. Let me see. I highlighted it because I was going to ask you about it. Well, I highlighted the word spiritual bankruptcy. I mean, I think
mm-hmm.
that so perfectly describes our country, spiritual bankruptcy. But let's see. What was the other word? It was a Whedon or something like that. What is it? Let me find
it. Which article?
In the one from the sandwich.
The one on Columbia, sure.
Yeah, on Columbia. But you were pretty much, you know, describing, you know, our country. You know, you were talking about. I thought I highlighted it. I'll keep looking for it here.
Okay, yeah, please see. I can talk a little bit about Columbia too, because you're right with the spiritual bankruptcy. I'll tell you, that Columbia piece was the beginning of all of this work for me. You know, I had done this healing work. With myself and getting in touch with this aspect, with the goddess aspect. And then I just was devouring things. Like I said, I was reading Barbara Walker. I was reading Susanna Budapest. I was reading Starhawk, Breonna Eisler. Just the list goes on. I just was trying to consume as much of this as I could. I got into another wonderful relationship and got married. And my wife has been a goddess practitioner for most of her life. And so she was really able to sort of coach and educate me as well on a lot of these things. And I started noticing, I heard the radio host, Tom Hartman. I don't know if you know him, the progressive
host. Yeah,
host.
I do. I'm wondering, do you think he's a closet pagan or a closet goddess person?
I think he is. Yeah, I really do. I've been able to have some interaction with him, and he actually was one of the first people to respond to this Columbia article, and it really gave me a boost because he wrote me and said that he just thought it was brilliant. And that made me happy because he was embracing the work.
Right.
And I thought, oh, good. If he's on board with this, that's a powerful thing. And the whole article started from me hearing something on his radio show where he had mentioned this. He said, you know, I don't know if anybody realizes this, but D.C. is called the District of Columbia. And you go to D.C., you go to all the buildings. You go to the Department of Justice, Department of the Interior, the Capitol, Department of Education, and there's this woman figure in front. You remember John Ashcroft tried to cover her up?
Yes, yes.
Attorney General.
The Library of Congress.
Library of Congress, yeah.
I mean, all of these virtues, ideas, they all have a female face.
Absolutely.
You know?
And the funny thing about this is coming from this city's being put together by men who were firm enforcers of the patriarchy. I mean, I wouldn't for a second suggest that the founding fathers were somehow sensitive to the goddess or putting forth overtly a kind of goddess consciousness. I think this was done totally subconsciously. I think when these men were thinking, what's the highest potentiality for our country? What's the highest, what is an image that represents the highest potential of what we want this land to be? And the image that comes to their mind is that of a sacred female.
Right.
It's inevitable, right? Even if you are absolutely drilled in the patriarchy, you know, Dante, I teach world literature as well, and it's always amazing to me when this pops up, and, you know, in the Divine Comedy, when Dante is on this journey through hell and up into heaven, you know, through purgatory and up into heaven, when he gets into heaven, before he gets into this final realm of divine white light, which is just this kind of undifferentiated place of bliss, and there's nothing there, the last thing he sees before he enters that light is the image of this woman, Beatrice, who is his kind of sage and you know, his muse and his divine guide. But it's the highest thing he can think of before he just enters this realm of pure light. And Dante is absolutely enforcing medieval Christian doctrine. I mean, he's not looking at all to consciously move people into a discussion of the sacred feminine. It's just he can't imagine an image of something more divine, more graceful, more benevolent, more connected than this image. And so this fascinated me about Columbia, because I thought, you know, this country does not represent the sacred feminine, and if anything, you could say it hates women, or at least devalues them. So what is this, and why is this here, and how is this working? And I really think the stuff on how the brain works. I mean, these images come out of our subconscious. Joseph Campbell would always talk about this. They just arise fully formed.
Well, think too about all of the cathedrals in Europe. I mean, most of them are built to the mother, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, I think it's just something in within us that we can't deny. It's primal. But I also think for some people, I'm thinking about like the DC 40 who were so against Columbia and wanted to rename the District of Columbia the District of Christ. I think about Sarah Palin's church who are at war with the Queen of Heaven. I think about the Pope who, when Avatar was so popular, he had somebody, his spokesman, come out and say, nature will never replace religion. Well, excuse me, nature should be our religion, you know.
And was our religion until this group of clowns came and took it over. You know, you're speaking my language there, and it's not any better with this new pope who's telling the nuns on the bus that they've been tainted by radical feminism because they care about sick and dying people and poor people.
Yeah, it's insane. But I wonder, though, you know, because you had that little part of your life when you were in that fundamentalist camp. Are they so anti-female? But I mean, what are they afraid of? You know,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, you know, I don't, you know, that's the only way I can put it. What are they so afraid of? Do they think the goddess is the devil?
You know, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One of them, you know, I can answer with a reference to the Columbia article we were speaking of, and the other one actually references another article I wrote that I don't know if I sent you, 50 Shades of Gaia.
No, send me that one, please.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. That was the one that was published in The Ecologist and deals with this sort of foundational element. But dealing with the Columbia one first, you know, I think it's no accident to me that this goddess figure is poised in New York Harbor and in Washington, D.C., the two seats of power in our country, right? The financial center, Wall Street, you know, the statue stares right at it. and in D.C. And I think there was something in us. There's always been something in people, going back to our earliest traditions, that knows that if our desires for control and for greed and for power over one another aren't tempered by something, that we'll destroy ourselves. I mean, we've always known this. Ancient, indigenous people know this. You have to build into your mythology a way to temper the anger and the violence of men. Indigenous cultures say if you don't initiate your young man, your man ages 18 to 30, that they will destroy your culture. And aren't we seeing that now? You know, with, I mean, all of these school shootings and this horrible thing in, you know, in Cleveland. I mean, that men ages 18 to 40, if not initiated, right, if they don't have a productive way to plug themselves into the mythology of the culture, mm-hmm. will just destroy it from the inside because of their own internal rage. And the image I get, you know, two things come up to me. One is what you said, this kind of spiritual bankruptcy. I started asking around and just asking colleagues and friends of mine what they knew about America's Goddess, about Columbia, about Libertas. And the answer was always nothing. What do you mean America's Goddess? We're a Christian country. Or, you know what I mean? And I would get, mm-hmm. I would get these kinds of answers back. And when I would bring up the Statue of Liberty or, the Columbia Goddess, they would always look at me and say, oh, that's just a statue. And it really became clear to me that we have a bankruptcy in this country. We are inundated with religion and religiosity. But you're right, we're bankrupt spiritually, and we really have lost the ability to learn how to read these mythological symbols, because you have to read them differently than you read with more left-brain, law-based, abstract religious ideas, right?
Right.
They communicate themselves to us differently. And the image that came to mind, and this is an answer to your question, what are these men afraid of, is a funny one, and I hope it's appropriate, but it's from the movie Goodfellas. I don't know if you've seen this movie.
The monster movie.
Yeah, so there's a scene in the movie where, it's Joe Pesci, it's Robert De Niro, and I think Ray Liotta, and they go over to Joe Pesci's either mother or grandmother's house, and they have this other guy in the trunk that they're going to eventually kill. And they go into the grandmother's house, and I think it's the grandmother, and they're all well-behaved, they're all sitting at the table, they're all yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, and they're having this meal, and they're being very polite, very sort of cultured, very tame individuals. And then he takes one of the kitchen knives with him, and then they leave and go drive down the road, and then they open the car and butcher this poor guy. And I thought, isn't that fascinating, right? This notion of when there's a crone present, when there's a powerful woman present, even if you're a cold-blooded killer, there's this notion of you behave yourself in front of that woman. Her presence trumps any part of your animal brutality.
Mm-hmm.
Just her very presence does. She's looking at you and saying, behave yourself, you know what I mean? In my presence, you won't do things to harm another person. Just her presence is supposed to remind you of that. And,
right.
And I thought, this is what's going on with these statues in New York and Washington, D.C. Now, of course, it hasn't worked, right, because we have a culture so bent on greed and competition and corruption and violence. But the notion, I think, was that by feminizing these things and by putting them in, again, New York and in D.C., we're saying to really the men who run this culture. And, I don't think this was a conscious message on the part of the founders or the people in New York. I think this is subconscious. I think this is something deep in our minds and hearts. You got to remember, we were goddess worshippers for 500,000 years before these patriarchies came along. And so I believe we have a cellular memory of these things, right, within us that goes back 500,000 years or so.
Yeah, I don't doubt that.
Anything to come back out, and it's starting to. The other part of your question, I think, as far as what are these men afraid of, so I think they don't want to be told they have to behave. I think they want to be greedy and violent and angry, and anything that seeks to limit that needs to be contained or destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah, because can you imagine the Koch brothers, mm-hmm. Having to, not being able to get their way? I mean, heaven forbid, not being able to buy Congress and, actually have an equality and, have to worry about being decent to their employees I found that word in your article. You were talking about The unsustainable nature of industrial civilization is based on and increasingly requires violence to maintain itself. Like cannibals, those people are societies afflicted with wetiko?
Oh, yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, that's a great concept. That is that comes directly from a friend of mine, an individual by the name of Paul Levy, who wrote a book by the same name called Wetiko, the greatest epidemic known to humanity or something like that. And this is a Native American term.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it says, Wetiko will consume the life force of others for private purpose or profit and do so without giving back something from their own lives. I mean, I have to tell you, Andrew, this feels like it is straight out of the last 2 years if you've been following politics. I can't help. Look, I'm upset with Obama for a lot of reasons, okay? He's no saint. But I have to tell you, I think he approached his job in a way that I felt like I saw the sacred feminine. He was trying to have a partnership. He was not a bully or a dominator, and you know, and he still is to a fault. You know, but the other side is, you know, won't have any of that. You know, the other side
they won't have
is,
any of it. They think compromise is doing everything they say.
Yes.
That's
what
they consider a compromise to be when they are not in the position of power. They say, you need to compromise with us, and what that means is you have to do 100%. And this is just like talking to a fundamentalist Christian. It's the same sickness. It's this idea that whatever my left hemisphere is telling me is the only legitimate reality, and anything else I have to either ridicule, dismiss, or destroy.
Right.
You know, I can't tell you how many religious people I've had conversations with when I say, you know, no one's trying to dismiss your perspective, but we're trying to also add our own.
Right.
And they say, not legitimate. You have to accept Christ and you have to do it this way or you're going to hell. Period.
Right.
I mean, you have to say everything that I say or it's curtains for you. And that goes to this wetiko sickness. But what Paul's book is about, it's a brilliant little book. Is when Europeans first landed in this country, and you know, we just it's so fun. It's not funny. It's tragically funny. But we just had this article come out the other day about them confirming cannibalism in the Jamestown settlement. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I did actually. Yeah, it looked like they ate a 14-year-old girl.
Yeah, of course. Well, of course, right? So there we are. I mean, you know, what a perfect example of you know, actually and mythologically what we're talking about here, and. You know, the fact that it was a girl too. Wetiko literally means cannibalism, but it's not. It can reply to actual cannibalism as in the Jamestown case, but it means a kind of spiritual cannibalism.
Right.
And emptiness. The natives recognized in the first settlers here that there was something psychologically wrong with us, and I really think that this is them recognizing what our systems of religion and patriarchy and governance, you know, kingship. Kingship, which is a gift that the gods bestow on man, you know, Marduk, which is the slayer of Tiamat, you know, one of the things he gives us is kingship, you know, and this whole notion of ruling over another and taking what you want from other people and from the land, ownership culture, the natives knew nothing of this, and really diagnosed us when they saw us. They said, these people are cannibals, and what they meant is they're eating themselves alive.
Yeah.
Because they've cut themselves off from nature, from the natural world, from their mythic home. And not only have they cut themselves off from it, and I think, boy, does this really explain manifest destiny and our whole desire to push out into the world and consume. And, you know, we are looking for something that we lost, and we keep filling this hole with goods, right? With resources.
Consumers. We're good little consumers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I've often thought, you know, I think I go back to the Koch brothers, the Mitt Romneys of the world, you know, and I think, you know what must it be like for them? And you know what I honestly imagine, and maybe I'm crazy, okay, but I imagine them with a big hole inside them that they can never fill, and that's why they have to keep, you know, cannibalizing companies and, you know, destroying the environment, all for more money than they could spend in 10 lifetimes. And you know what? They still don't fill that hole inside of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we turn on the very thing that brought us into this world. I mean, what you know, if you want to talk about a cultural cannibalism, you know, to turn on women, to one of the things I say in one of the pieces, because one of the things I've been addressing lately is the, you know, the gender spectrum and its relationship to feminism and to women, because this is a whole new problem and complication that we're dealing with. But one of the things that I've said before is that, you know, all women aren't mothers, but all people are born from mothers. And we have to really be aware of that in terms of our mythological discussions, this mother archetype. When I was speaking with Genevieve Vaughn about this issue and asking her about Eisenstein's book, she said, you know, absolutely what you said in the beginning. She said, you know, I'm thankful for Charles's book. It's going to reach an audience that of people that wouldn't have read mine. You know, it's men coming on board with this concept. What she was saying also, though, is that she thinks this mothering aspect needs to stay with the metaphor for now, because we're a culture that desperately needs to be mothered again,
mm-hmm.
right? That desperately needs to reconnect to that mother archetype, that feminine archetype, in all of its benevolence and in all of its ferocity, right? We have to value women again as the progenitors of the culture. And if we don't do, I mean, Nicholas Kristof's work is all about this. This is the fastest way to reform your culture.
Andrew, hold that thought. Lines. Hold that thought. I see Carl has popped up on the switchboard, and I want to say hello to him and sort of release him from tonight's show, because I know his daughter is in the hospital. And since,
oh, yeah, my goodness.
Yeah, since we started the show tonight in his time slot, and he's sort of getting to us an hour late, I'm just going to thank him for calling and hope he will be kind enough to reschedule another time when he, you know,
certainly pass along our best to his daughter.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me say hello to Carl.
Sure.
Carl, hi. Are you with us?
Yes. And I guess maybe I was totally discombobulated about the time. I was under the impression it was 6:55 Pacific time. So I guess I'm an hour late.
Yeah. Well,
I
apologize, Carl. Yeah, you did. Fortunately, Andrew was listening in, so when you didn't come online, he jumped in. Would you feel okay with me just finishing the conversation with Andrew tonight and maybe having you back when you're not distracted with your daughter in the hospital?
In fact, I have been enjoying the conversation. I've been listening for about, I guess, five or ten minutes now, and wow, what a great conversation.
Well,
I think you guys should kind of continue on, and thank you so much for your kindness and understanding, and I'm so sorry. I don't know if you know this story, but, yeah, my daughter is medically fragile, and it's actually tonight's the first night in almost 2 years she's been in the hospital, but unfortunately she's running a very high fever, and because of her condition, we have to take care of her. I totally understand.
I'll be in touch with you to reschedule you for another time, and our prayers are with her. Thank you for even trying to do the show tonight. I really appreciate that, Carl,
and we'll have you
back on another time, because we want to talk about your topic, too.
I'm going to tune in, Carl, when you come back on, because I'm very excited to hear what you have to bring to the program.
Wonderful. And, I'll be in touch. And so thank you for your kindness and you know, many blessings to you, and enjoy the rest of your conversation.
Okay. Thank you so much, Carl. Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay. So, Andrew, we were saying, hold that thought about mothers. You know, we need more mothering. It reminded me, I had a guest on by the name of Art Noble, and he's a sociologist or psychologist, I forget now, but he said he thought one of the most important things we could do to help heal our humanity, to help heal our sons, is to not pull them away from their mothers so quickly. They really need more time with their mothers than they do on the playground in this patriarchal world that's going to shape them into something that they really might not want to be.
Boy, isn't that true? Yeah, I think he's onto something there for sure.
Yeah. Well, we've already chatted for almost an hour, and I want to get to the Cave of Forgotten Dreams. But
sure.
before we do, was there any, you know, we sort of just talked around the whole issue, but I guess I want to ask you, you know, when it comes to our society, when it comes to our quote, you know, air quotes here, Christian nation, the only thing I've heard from anyone that made any sense to me in terms of how we can heal ourselves, how we can, you know, have, you know, try to get conservatives to have more empathy, you know, to try to be a more caring and sharing sort of, you know, culture, you know, because we have this amygdala problem with the conservatives. I mean, they literally have a different brain structure than liberals do. You know, women have said to me, you know, women shrinks and, you know, sociologists have said, love is the only thing that will make these people stop being so fearful. You know, they haven't had enough of it. That's what they need. You know, I guess I just wonder what you think about that. And I don't know how we can love the Koch brothers, how we can love, these Tea Party Republicans that, you know, are determined to, you know, drag us back into the dark ages and prevent us from having any progress in the world. I mean, you've been thinking about this for a while. Do you have any ideas on realistically how we can shift that attitude, especially when you've got this big bullhorn like Fox News that they have that sort of condones all this ugliness?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's tough to, you know, when you go on to, you know, not that I ever do this, but I hear the reports of Rush Limbaugh coming on the air and immediately moaning about the fact that the child who was born to one of these girls who was held captive in Cleveland and was raped repeatedly is probably now going to be on welfare.
He
absolutely said that yesterday. I mean, he went right on the air and said, you know, well, great, a bunch more welfare. Now she's going to be getting twice the welfare for her and the kid. That was his response to the story to a woman who was held captive and chained in a dungeon for 10 years.
Wow.
And so it's mind-boggling, one, to think, how can a person even think this? How could they say it out loud? How could millions of people want to hear it? And then how can we not only try to have rational conversations with these people, but much less, you know, offer love and patience and healing to them? And this is a very difficult question. I think, you know, there's a couple of things that come to mind. You know, from my perspective, one is I think we have to keep working on all of the people out there that aren't like that. You know, there are millions of people in this world who are good and loving and open people, just need to be shown the path forward. And I think a lot of what you see in our culture, especially with this, you know, this neo-shamanism, these people that are flying to Peru to take ayahuasca or, you know, going into Central America and South America to study with indigenous peoples. I think we see such a real craving on the part of so many in this culture that they're recognizing that the systems of economics, our system of education, our systems of religion have failed us and aren't serving the people and aren't serving the world anymore. And so they're desperate for something else and they're open. And so I think there's great opportunity there, you know, through social networking, through these kinds of conversations to really make headway with all of the people who aren't like Rush Limbaugh and the Koch brothers right now, what to do with them? You know, I think it starts a little bit with understanding. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind for me is the same thing I thought about my own mother, that I had to focus on what made these people that way. What made them this way? What caused them to become so filled with fear, so filled with anger, so filled with this hostility towards women and towards the natural world? That they're just blinded by their own rage. And again, it's consuming them. And I think if we can identify that thing and then go to work on that, that might unlock something to them. One of the things in our conversations by email back and forth between, before I came on the show, that I told you is that my training as a pastor not only gave me a training in Bible, right, like Greek and Hebrew, and then just I spent years in the biblical text, doing high-level, you know, interpretive kinds of stuff. And so I'm able to slip back into that shorthand and into that jargon with evangelicals and try to push back on a few things, right? And so I think maybe another thing that we can do, as difficult as it is become literate in their system. You know what I mean? Like the more it would be extremely difficult for an evangelical to sit down with somebody like Barbara Walker and make their case because she knows the Bible so well.
Right.
right? And so that really stops people in their tracks when they're trying to sort of push, because as you said before, so many people push their own misogyny, their own hatred, their own brokenness, their own racism, their own homophobia, and just call it a message from God,
mm-hmm.
right? And when we can divest them of that and say, this is coming from you, now let's talk about why you feel this way about the world. And what I've tried to do in my writing is keep that sort of altar call aspect to it. I really think we need a society of cooperation, a society not where one person has the right answer, but where we sort of come together and all take our little flashlights and shine them up and at the wall and see what we're looking at together. But initially, I really do think it's time to make people declare. And what I've tried to do in my writing, especially when I direct it to monotheists, is I try to get them to really pick a side. Where are you in this fight to save the planet? Where are you in this fight to bring humanity together? Where are you in this discussion to try to start thinking about our home as the earth and not this country? And when we can make people change the frame a little bit, right, and change the way they're thinking about the world and their connection to it, I think that opens up the conversation to then go to the next step and say, okay, how are we living are we living in ways that makes that more difficult, that destroys that thing we're actually going after? And if we are, how can we change that? I mean, it's a very difficult process, and I know, I don't know how satisfying my answer is. But I think, some of these people, we're just going to have to try to wait out until they die and hope they don't reproduce. I know that sounds harsh, too. But,
no, I've thought that, quite frankly.
You look at the young people, you look at something like, same-sex marriage, and, kids age, 15 to 25, 80% of them are absolutely fine with it. We really are at this kind of tipping point on a lot of these issues.
Right.
I think maybe even 20 years from now, we'll be looking back saying, I can't believe we used to argue about that stuff.
No, and I agree with you, and I don't think there is an easy answer because our dialogue has gotten so polarized, and moderate Republicans, I blame them a lot too. I really do, and because they have not stood up to these extremists and said, wait, you are hijacking our party. This is not what we stand for,
Yeah, where are the Goldwaters? Where are the Bob Doles? Where are these people?
And I get mad at the Christians, too, because, the moderate and progressive Christians, because they're letting evangelicals hijack Christianity and turn it into something, ugly and dominating, dominating and oppressive. I mean, not that, what I'm talking about. The church has their rules, but, the people, they're like cafeteria Christians. You pick and choose the stuff you're going to follow. And there are lots of wonderful progressive Christians out there that don't believe in any of the stuff that they're. I mean, they're like the nuns, for instance.
Right.
The nuns.
With this.
Yeah, the nuns are like what the church should really be about. It's the men. The Vatican and all of those folks that have lost touch.
Right, absolutely. And I struggle with this because I go back and forth with several friends. Bill McKibben, the environmentalist, is a person I've had some contact with over the years, and he's a Christian. And I said to him recently, how's that working out for you, trying to convince that community to take the environment seriously? Because from our standpoint, from the work we do with goddess consciousness, it's right there. The goddess is the manifestation of the natural world. And so when BP goes into the Gulf of Mexico and dumps all of that oil and then all of that dispersant, it literally is like someone taking your mother's mouth, opening it, and dumping a bunch of poison down there.
Yeah. And I have trouble with pagans, too. I don't know if you've ever heard me say it on the show, but, I was having a lot of difficulty in my mind. How do I contend, during the presidential election, that campaign that lasted forever, pagans who cannot connect the dots between being pagan and supporting Republicans. Where is that disconnect? Don't you care about women? Don't you care about the environment? You have friends who are gay. Maybe you don't care about immigrants, but what about the rest?
we are a culture that is really all about radical self-promotion and self-advocacy, and then anything outside of that is really diminished. I agree with you. I have a list of problems with the current administration as well. But I remember back when he was running the first time, and I was watching the, I think it was blood pressure shoots through the roof, but I was watching the Republican convention, and Rudy Giuliani was speaking, and he was talking about Obama as a community organizer, and the snarl coming out of his mouth.
Yeah.
And the disdain for that phrase when he was like community organizer. You might as well have said, I think if he was somebody who molested children, Giuliani wouldn't have been as upset about it.
Yeah,
idea of going and getting people to be active, to come outside and talk to one another. I mean, this is what I loved about the Occupy movement, even though there was all kinds of problems with it, just getting people to come into out into the world and into the public sphere and talk to one another.
Right.
And say, what's driving you? What do you care about? Well, here's what's driving me. Let's see if we can work this out. I mean, that we need more of that happening, and it is happening. But they hate this. They want people to stay isolated. It's divide and conquer.
Yeah,
right?
Well,
it's
I mean, Occupy scared the shit out of them, you know? I mean, it was the, you know, it threatened the status quo. Finally, the people were starting to feel empowered, and what did they do? You know, they turn our militaristic police forces on innocent people. It was shameful. It was really a national scandal as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's law, and it's power, and it's, you know, to go to, you know, one of the other articles I read, I told you, 50 Shades of Gaia. I wrote it for The Ecologist because I wanted to explain from my perspective as a mythologist where this comes from. Where I was talking specifically about the deep psychology of the climate change deniers, and you know, not ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers. We know why these people don't care about the science and are invested in not listening to it, just because they're making billions of dollars. But the poor, the rank and file, the people that just live on this planet, who get the dirty air, the dirty water, the inability to eat fish out of the Gulf anymore. What do they get out of this? How are they so easily convinced? And I traced this back all the way to our originator cosmologies, all the way back to the Fertile Crescent, to the Sumerian and Babylonian myths. And you mentioned, Tiamat before, and in the Enuma Elish, I'm sure if you know her name, I'm sure you know this, but in the Babylonian creation story, Ea, which is a forerunner to Yahweh, actually. There's a lot of information that suggests that these are the same individuals. But this guy, Ea, has a child, Marduk, and this would make Marduk this kind of Christ figure, right, the son of God. And the first thing they do is plot to kill the sacred mother, Tiamat, right, because Marduk wants to wrestle her creative power from her. And they are militaristic. Marduk's, he has a chariot. He gives kingship to mankind. His chariot is pulled by his team of horses, and their names are, if I get this right, Killer, Crusher, Unyielder, and Fleet, right? Mm. Right. So we see the energy here, right? And the first thing they do is destroy the Sacred Mother, dismember her corpse, and make the heavens and the earth with it, right? And then mankind is created, and there's some different versions of this, either from her blood, to keep this metaphor, as Barbara Walker and Margaret Mead and others have pointed out, of in the old religions that we thought children came just from menstrual blood. We didn't realize men had anything to do with it.
Right.
And Marduk takes the blood, kneads it together, either of her blood or of a sacrificial victim named Kingu. There's some different versions of the story, and makes mankind out of this and puts them on the earth to work and on behalf of the gods, right? The original idea was that there was a tree of life and a tree of knowledge in this kind of sacred grove, and the gods ate from them, which helped them be immortal and helped them be omniscient, right? It was this sacred fruit coming out of the earth that made them these things, but they didn't want to do the work to get the fruit. So humanity was made as a kind of slave race in order to toil the ground of this rotting, dismembered corpse of the Sacred Mother on behalf of these murderous deities, Ea and Marduk. And this is an amazing story. I mean, it's terrifying. It
sounds like corporations and workers, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. It's the absolute template for everything that's come after it, including the biblical story, and including, as you just said, our whole system of government, our whole system of economics. Our economic model is built on the same thing. And at that point, and this is also at the beginning of writing systems and, when agriculture, at least in the Fertile Crescent, is starting to take off. And that there's a great book by a guy named Leonard Slane called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess.
Yeah.
Where he goes through this. His daughter is really doing wonderful work too, Tiffany. And he goes through how these, you know, cuneiform and then the writing systems that followed it rewired our brains into left hemisphere dominant machines. And along with it come systems of law and mythological systems of power and control and oppression. And this is all based on this kind of several thousand year hallucination we've been in by living too much over into one hemisphere of the brain. And law comes at this point as well, written law. Prior to this, people lived by custom and you know, tribal taboos. And there were a handful of them, but not that many, right? But law is a different thing. Law comes down from the mountaintop. Law comes down from the hierarchy. Law comes down from the priest or the king or the god. And it's a way to control people even when the authority figure isn't there. It's a way to make them perpetually guilty of something, right, and keep them under control. And the first law ever written down, referenced in the Code of Hammurabi, but the first law ever written, I don't know if you know this or not, was if a woman disrespects her husband, she should be smashed in the mouth with a hot brick.
No, I didn't know that. How
the
can I not know that?
First law ever written, yeah.
Wow.
And, I mean, so you see right at the beginning, you know, where the thought error was, and then it just gets copied and copied and copied and copied for the next 7,000 years over and over again.
So that's
and
even
that's
before the Bible. I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
So we can't blame
years.
The Bible.
Right. Well, the Bible, you know, they were just pulling from this material.
Right.
Right, so they're very same system. But where I was going in 50 Shades of Grey, and this really ties back to our conversation earlier about what are these men so afraid of, is that, you know, the Mother Earth myth is, or, you know, symbol has always been with us, right? The feminized body of the world that gives birth to all that is, right, and provides for all of her children. It's always been, you know, this Mother Earth motif. And in the earlier goddess religions, you know, that we hopefully can talk about Chauvet in a minute, too. As you know, these are models of partnership. These are models of living in harmony with the cycles of time and with the natural world. With the advent of agriculture and with the advent of writing systems, we totally changed our association, not only with one another, but with nature. Now, nature is not something that we just have to live within the cycles of as hunter-gatherers. Now nature is something that we can manipulate and control through planting, through agriculture.
Right.
Right. But this metaphor then gets carried over into women as well, right? And so women aren't something, right? The natural world, which is feminized, is no longer something we have to live in partnership and harmony with. This is something that we can exploit for our
and
own
dominate.
Wealth.
Well, and I remember something, too. It's also something about men. You know, and I'm saying, and when I say men, I sort of mean humankind, but maybe
mm-hmm.
mankind. They are also, you know, they also want to try to overcome, to try to somehow game the system in terms of the, you know, it's like they're denying the cycles of life.
Absolutely.
It's as if they can, you know, they, I guess they know logically that they aren't immortal, but they can't face their mortality either. And the goddess is about the cycles of life. And to accept
absolutely.
The goddess is to accept that you're going to die. And there's
something. And this is another reason we hate women, is because we blame you for birthing us, because once we're born, we now have this fear of death. You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is a crippling fear in men, especially when they don't understand these larger cycles, as you're talking about. We live with this crippling existential fear of death, and we blame our mothers for that. And so in the sense that the Bible is right, and what I mean by that is, yes, our mothers birthed us into this world, and it's a world that is difficult to live in. Right, and people suffer, and people grow old, and people die, and people, you know, we have things like just happened with your other guest's daughter. You know, this is a difficult place to be, and some people respond to that by becoming kind of pathological with that fear and just going into absolute denial. And I think when you create a system that says, okay, now there's this all powerful, male deity who's going to protect me and make sure that I don't ever die, or when I do die, I'll be resurrected. Anything that threatens to take that away from you, you're going to try to destroy,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you finally got over this fear of death by believing you're going to go to heaven and not die. And then if someone starts talking to you about cycles of time again, because time is linear in the patriarchal models, in their religion. It's not cyclical. It doesn't come back on itself. It moves forward towards some future event, you know, the second coming or something. Absolutely, you know, and in these fertile crescent myths, which the absolute archetype for everything that comes after it, the control of the natural world and control of women, both functionally are two sides of the same coin that have to do with a suppression of this larger fear of death.
Well, you know, we're starting to run short on time, and I mean, I could talk to you for a long time about this, but we're going to have to start wrapping it up, and I want to get to a couple other ideas. First of all, you know, in your talking points, you mentioned the tide is slowly turning in academia towards embracing the evidence regarding the goddess worship, and I guess I'm just wondering, point to some examples of that for me, because I've been feeling like that hasn't been the case. You know, people like Ian Hodder, for instance, you know, there's still so many people out there that still think this is a feminist fantasy and that that this has been debunked and it's really not true. But, I mean, examples like I think the Cave of Forgotten Dreams, I think are perfect examples that maybe prove it, don't you?
Yeah, boy, this is another really tough question, and this is, I can maybe start the answer to this by talking a little bit about the cave, but, you know, and trying to direct it to this question. You know, the issue starts with this, with the Venus statues, and anybody who studies ancient religion, paleo religion, there's two things that come up, and these are both perfect projections of the left hemisphere again. The first thing that is becoming kind of axiom in anthropology and mythological circles is that since these cultures were pre-literate, since they didn't leave us a written record of their beliefs, you know, a Bible, we have no idea what they believed, right? You know, that's just it's just something that almost people demand as an article of faith, that their belief systems are forever lost to us because they weren't written down. This is profoundly untrue. It's profoundly untrue because they weren't literate people, and so they didn't write their beliefs, they didn't communicate their beliefs through the written word. And so, of course, they didn't write them down, right? And because they're not able to. They think about the world in a totally different way. We have cultures all across this world, indigenous people that still practice the very things that people in these caves practiced, you know, 30, 40, 50, 100,000 years ago. You know, when I sat with Susanna Budapest, she's telling me about, you know, her family and them practicing these ancient traditions going back to, you know, to the very beginning, coming out of Lake Vasily in Siberia. So we still have access to all of the things that these people in this day were practicing. Thirdly, more and more evidence is being uncovered, right, all the time. Right, including, as I was saying, in brain research, neuropsychology, evolutionary biology, consciousness studies, all of these things are opening doors through which are giving us a scientific terminology to talk about goddess figurines, goddess consciousness, goddess religion in a whole new way that many in the scientific community are seem to be, at least at this point, a little more open to. That the next thing that's changing is the world is in such peril. Right, environmentally, politically, socially, that people are really starting to come to terms with the fact. I mean, there's a lot of delusion and denial out there still, but there people are really starting to come to terms with the fact that we got to change something. Something's not quite right, and so I think that's happening in scholarship as well. Lastly, and then I'll give you a couple of specifics. The quantum revolution, you know, the thing that happened in physics to get people to understand a couple of things that are Cartesian paradigm, this dualism, this Aristotelian, rational, logical, scientific method is lacking in certain ways. It's not that it's wrong and we need to abandon it. It's that this whole idea of the mind-body split, this whole idea of the rational mind being the only thing that can provide us with any kind of objective truth, the quantum physicists already realized, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago that this was no longer true, that the universe is a chaotic place and that chaos is not a negative term as it has always been, you know, expressed in the religious context, but it's actually the place out of which creativity emerges, and that there's this connectivity to the cosmos that has everything energetically, biochemically, right, connected to one another. And so these are very ancient ideas, mythologically speaking. And so that revolution, that quantum revolution, is starting to make its way into the other disciplines. So, you know, 10 years ago, to mention to a group of anthropologists the name Maria Gumbutsis would make three quarters of them walk out of the room.
Right. And she was the one who was really getting it, as far as I'm concerned.
She was the one who was really getting it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I came across her work, it blew me away. And then secondarily, discoveries like Chavez are really just putting another pin on the map, saying that we have to take this seriously. I mean, because if we looked at, you know, Gumbutsis' work in what she called Old Europe, you know, and the stuff that she would say, not, you know, with the figurines and the fact that no paintings of humans fighting each other in Neolithic or Paleolithic, no real discrepancies in graves in terms of between rich and poor, right? Everyone's kind of buried the same. No real discrepancies in housing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People just shared.
Yeah.
What you were talking about earlier, and we, you know, so the archaeology is sort of coming. Is coming back around to this a little bit too. And, you know, the Venus statues, this is kind of what got me into writing the article, is that watching the misunderstanding there, and this is something that really comes from, again, the left hemisphere of the brain that just has a whole different taxonomy, a whole different way of working with images. And when we see the Venus of Willendorf, right, when we see the Venus of Holofels, when we see, the Venus of Chavez or Tonton, any of these ones, right, that exist, Gumbutsis understood, and other scholars like her, that these are all manifestations of a psychic energy. Joseph Campbell talks about that. These deities are not real things. These deities are manifestations of deep subconscious energy that precedes their form, right? And the image itself is just a manifestation of that energy. So all goddess figurines are manifestations of the same subconscious energy. A mythologist understands that. Anthropologists do not. They don't see that as a taxonomy at all. They think this god is different than this god is different than this god is different than this god. Saying all of those Venuses represent the goddess principle is like saying Zeus and Yahweh and Thor and Ra all represent the god principle, the masculine assertive principle. Now, of course, I would say that too, right? But this drives researchers nuts, because they've been taught their whole careers that you have to divide and separate. Right, that the way to do proper scholarship is to make sure none of these things touch. It's a very kosher way to be.
rather than them all, you know, sharing the in a way, it's like rather than them putting all of their work together and creating a stew, they want to keep it specialized and separated. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I saw an article in the Smithsonian that was actually looking at one of these Venus statues, the Venus of Holofels, and of the title of, this is in the Smithsonian, and the title of the article was, you know, Discovery Shows Shed Light on Potential Ancient Porn, right, is what they called it, right, as if these statues were just, again, men carving them for their own sexual enjoyment. And I just thought, oh my God, so I need to write this article about that. And after having seen the Herzog film, and seeing all of the scholars, well-meaning people in that movie. I mean, there are people in that film that really want, they're very moved by the images that they're looking at, but they just don't have the vocabulary yet to explain it. There's a scientist named Julien Monnier who says several times, he just says these amazing things, and he talks about having gone into the cave and seen these images and been so moved by them that he was coming out and dreaming of lions every night, both real and painted ones, and he wasn't afraid. It was bringing these deep things out of himself. And he said, you know, I'm a scientist, but I'm also a human being. And to me, that was the right hemisphere of his brain saying, you bring the science over here. Bring your discipline over into this larger notion of connectivity, right, and experiential truth. And then you'll connect the dots, right? Then it'll be like plugging in the light.
Yeah,
right? And it'll all come together. But these scientists have been taught to leave anything subjective, like their emotion, their emotional response to these things is somehow not fair game as part of their analysis. And
yeah, and that's why they discredited Gimbutas so much.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Ward wrote a book about the goddess from the male point of view, and he calls this idea looking at the world through both eyes. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you wouldn't think of going through life just looking out of one eye. You look out of both eyes,
mm-hmm.
and that's sort of the whole idea of you need the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of the brain. But, you were reminding me of a PBS special that was on. It was a six-hour special called, I think, How Art Changed the World or Art
mm-hmm.
Formed the World, something like
mm-hmm.
that. And they had the Venus of Willendorf. And I wanted to just throw something at the television as I'm
yeah.
watching it, because this guy was interpreting the size of the Venus of Willendorf not as, this ample mother who provides everything we need to sustain ourselves, which
yes,
is what, the way I see the Venus. He was saying that people, they carved the statues so that they didn't look anything like normal people, because, they felt that that was perfection. Perfection
yeah.
didn't look like normal people. Perfection was bigger. I might not have it exactly right, but the point
yeah, talk
is
talk about a projection. Wow.
But the point was they didn't really get it. They weren't. They
mm-hmm.
It was so obvious he knew nothing about goddess spirituality.
And I've heard, this notion that in the ancient world a heavyset woman was more revered because she was more virile and more able to withstand the winter and all this kind of thing. And I'm not saying there's nothing to that. There are still cultures in this world that will absolutely do this. Before a young girl gets married, they try to fatten her up because this is seen as some sort of prize to the family. And so I get this, but that doesn't explain the presence of these statues.
Right.
Right. I mean, these things, and that doesn't explain, especially in the caves, that they adorn very, really sacred places in these caves. And the Venus statues, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say quickly to listeners, you can probably see on Netflix or something like that, you can still see The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and
yeah,
we
absolutely.
Have to highly, highly, highly recommend it.
So, in answer to your question about the change, I saw this film in 2010, And as you said, I was blown away by the cave, but underwhelmed by the film. Listening to the archaeologists talk about it and not connect the dots, they would be looking at these partnership animals, these cave bears, and not talking about regeneration. They go, oh, look over here. The first animal ever painted in here was a butterfly and a dragonfly. That's interesting. Look over here. There's these animals with extensive horns and accentuated horns. That's interesting. Look over here. There's a section of lions, sitting in submissive attention to this bison Venus figurine. That's interesting. And I was saying, yeah, but interpret it. Like, don't be afraid to say what it means. And I think there's this idea still in Paleolithic art that the images are connected to one another, that the people just went in and painted animals because either for fun or recreation or because it's what they saw. But the fact that there's an intentionality to it and a connectivity to it, a story being told about these people and how they saw the world and how they felt connected to it is still to a large extent lost on us. And by us, I mean the people working in the cave, the people doing this work. And so to that extent, I would say you're right. We're not making much progress here, but, I have a degree in religion, I have a degree in literature, and I sat down and wrote this piece and sent it out to Popular Archaeology, which is the first place I wanted to send it. I thought about National Geo. They don't take unsolicited material, and Popular Archaeology took it and featured it. And so that was a first indication to me that something was changing, because their editor wrote me and he said, I think this is a brilliant perspective on the cable, putting it in the magazine. And here we go. And I've received very little negative feedback from it. I mean, as I've been going out on the road and speaking about the cave, as I've been going to different academic conferences, I just got back from the Society for the Anthropology of Consciousness conference in New Orleans, and a room full of anthropologists and archaeologists, and they were all on board with this. People like Stan Krittner, like I said, Sharon Mahari's, a lot of Richard Katz, a lot of wonderful folks down there that we're all behind this and absolutely said it's about time that we started, that people, more people are talking about Paleolithic religion in a serious way. And then
well,
lastly, I would say,
yeah,
absolutely. And then lastly, I would say, you know, the Venuses of Tonton and Barakat Ram, I mean, these are 250 to 500,000 years old.
Right, and don't forget the Acheulean goddess, too, that
absolutely.
Could potentially be even older.
Even older, right. And so we're going back, you know, 600,000 to 800,000 years, which is a really a difficult thing for the Christians to think about because they don't even believe the universe is that old, right? But,
right.
But, we are, you know, I have this sense that people in academia are open to this. Now, is the progress slower than I would like? Absolutely. But as I've gone forward and published the thing on, you know, on Columbia, published the thing here on Chavez, all of my colleagues are just excited about it and want to participate. And I really have been really been moved by that.
Well, I'm really happy about that. And you know, and whether it comes from a man or a woman, I could care less.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just glad that the information is out there. You know, and that it's being accepted and not rejected like poor Maria Gimbutas, you know, had to experience. So maybe we are evolving. You know, maybe people are. But I mean, how do you answer someone who says to you, how, you know, we think of these Paleolithic people as no more as unsophisticated
mm-hmm.
cavemen? I think that's part of the problem, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean, we don't think of them as, you know, as being that sophisticated to be able to come up with these ideas.
Yeah, and boy, that's really something that that's really starting to change as well. This notion of humanity sort of growing in complexity from these kind of simplistic, you know, as you say, these people just with a, you know, very kind of bare bones understanding of the world to, you know, to the more sophisticated life we have now and consciousness we have now. One, something like the art in Chavez clearly shows you that's one of the things that's good about the movie is when you see this art, you realize this art was not made by simple people.
Yeah.
Right, that these people have. Go ahead.
Well, and I really love how you so totally explain the art so well, because I think the most I've ever read that, you know, that in terms of interpretation, the most, as far as I've ever read it taken, was, okay, the shaman was having an out-of-body experience for, and somehow communing with the animal for the hunt. But it didn't
mm-hmm.
go any further than that. The goddess
yes.
wasn't part of it. You know,
right.
I mean, you really explore it much more fully.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I, you know, I really think it's because it's such a key aspect to understanding the whole thing. When you're talking about people who are still living in the food chain, when you're talking about people who have to, with the naked eye, make astrological observations to understand where they are in the seasonal cycles, and so they don't freeze to death or miss an opportunity to gather certain plants, medicinal or food-wise, or their understanding of certain animal migrations and how they would have to be in certain places in order to hunt them at that time.
They had to understand all of this. Andrew, it was a different respect for nature. See, we
mm-hmm.
have none anymore is the problem. We're too removed from it. And maybe that's, you know, I'm stating the obvious, but maybe I'm not, you know.
We have a group of people here who, you know, on their own had to have a, you know, if you got sick, there were no pharmacies, there were no doctors. These people had to have a pharmacopoeia of natural plants that were medicinal. That, I mean, in the Amazonian basin, there are, you know, 30, 40 different kinds of plants. And these people had that working knowledge of most of them, which they could use, which they couldn't, and what they could use them for. And so these, I think the definition of ancient peoples being simplistic is one that we're also really starting to move away from at this point, because in many ways they were far more sophisticated than we are today.
So if listeners want to read your article on the forgotten wisdom of the Chauvet Cave, where can they get a copy of that?
Yeah, now there's so how popular archaeology works now is it's online only. And if they go to the website, they'll be to their website at populararchaeology.com, they'll be instructed to sign up for, if they search for the article and then click on it, it'll say that they need an account, that they need a subscription to view it. But my understanding is as long as you just sign up, like name and email address, then that counts. You can get a free subscription. There's no money involved. If for some reason that doesn't work, people are, you know, I should have a website up in the next couple of months, but people are more than willing, I'm fine with them tracking me down on Facebook or somewhere else, and I'll just send them a PDF. You know, it's absolutely fine as well.
And tell them how they find your other articles on Reality Sandwich.
Okay, yeah, I have two on Reality Sandwich. One is this one on Columbia, which is called In Goddess We Trust, America's Spiritual Crossroads. And then I have another one on Reality Sandwich that's a little headier. It's a little bit longer, but it's called The Sacred Marriage of Visible Logos and Epigenetic Consciousness. That's a mouthful there, but it's really examining this notion of language. And, you know, I was so excited to hear about you having Dr. Chomsky on. He was one of the people, I should let you know this, he was one of the early readers of my Columbia article as well. And was very supportive of it, and we had a great dialogue about it. And so he very much is on board with the kind of thing you're doing. And one of the things we talked about is how language is used to create systems of control through dictating systems of thought. And that's what my other article on Reality Sandwich is about, especially
okay.
from the sort of mythological standpoint. And then I have the other one that I've been mentioning is 50 Shades of Gaia, which is the article about the climate change denial movement and its sort of mythological roots in the Babylonian story.
And is that available?
Yes, and that's on the Ecologist website.
Okay, wonderful.
And all of those are free. There's no, again, besides the Chavez Cave, that's the only one. And I think there's no money there either. I think you just have to sign up for something, but all of the other things you don't.
Okay. Well, Andrew, we're probably 4 minutes left here. Can you quickly tell us about your book on the Spider Woman?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, this is a funny thing. The native Spider Woman, so her legend really exists with Pueblo, Hopi, and Navajo, so American Southwest. And a friend of mine, who, again, I would love for you to have on, Sharon Mahares, I don't know if you know her work or her books. She has a great book called The Root of All Evil. Her last name is M-I-J-A-R-E-S. And she's just a brilliant anthropologist, works with the UN and does a lot of work in Central and South America. I'm reading an article of hers right now and responding to it for a journal called Earth, Gender, and Ceremony. And it's about the landscape in Latin American mythology, in particular Incan mythology and Aztec mythology, and how it represents this aspect of gender and fluidity as well, very much along the lines of what my Chavez article is about. And she mentions that in Aztec civilization, there are places that give reference to this great goddess also through which all life is born, and she is the Spider Woman in the Navajo tradition. It's really interesting character that is kind of a side character in many other myths. She just pops up for a second and then disappears. But when you start exploring her a little bit more, you realize that she is she's called the Weaver of Thoughts. She's she sews she knits together the cosmos itself. And so she's a creator deity. She creates the first two deities that then create the rest of the gods in Navajo and Pueblo tradition, and then also the land and the people and the animals itself. And so she's the kind of initiator of existence itself. And what's amazing about her, I grew up with fear spiders, like a lot of us do in the West, and so this is a character that I stayed away from for a while in my studies. But then I realized it's not about the spider, it's about the web. And this web is a web of connectivity. This, again, goes back to this concept of Gaian connectivity that I've been talking about. And this
right.
web is the web of existence, right? And this native notion that mankind doesn't exist in a hierarchy, but this pyramid structure, right, with man
right.
at the top or God at the top or the king at the top. But we don't exist in a pyramid. We exist in a web. We're but one thread of that web, and anything you do to one side, to one part of the web, is going to affect the other part. And I started thinking about, where else does that apply? That applies, you know, what other kinds of webs and networks do we have, and how are they used in creative capacities? And I was thinking about social networks and that kind of web. I was thinking about neural networks in our brain itself and how the brain works and how it, you know, and when it's thriving, and balanced, it produces a certain kind of output. When it's not, it produces another. And that's really what our whole conversation is about.
Mycelium networks
and these kinds of things in the ground. And then lastly, because I know we're almost out of time, the cosmos itself, you know, astrophysicists and these quantum folks have been telling us about string theory and that the universe itself is held together by this kind of energetic web that is nowhere and everywhere at once and is a kind of invisible yet very real web of energy that all life and all matter arises out of and returns to and literally is connected to everything else in the cosmos at one time. Right, and that's a profound thing to think about. And the Native people knew this, and they feminized that, right? Just like the Indians do with Kali, that there's this energetic void of which we all emerge from and return to. And this is this grandmother spirit, the Spider Woman.
You know, I love it. I love it. And I can't help but think, you know, that it just reminds me how arrogant our white man's culture is,
mm-hmm.
You know, how in the West, you know, we thought we have all the answers and we put down these indigenous people
mm-hmm.
as being, you know, inferior to us when, they're very obviously the ones who have had the answers all along, you know.
I mean, think about how, you know, we're in this immigration debate right now, and I think, boy, we're telling people that have lived on this land for 10, 15, 20,000 years, you know, that they can't come here, and even though their ancestors have been here for that long. And also, just, to, you know, as you said before, they think about the natural land. Think about what this country looked like when we took it from those people and what their systems of mythology, like this Spider Woman one, and reinforcing in people that they're connected to everyone and everything around them. I mean, that makes them treat the land differently.
And you have
ownership of the land.
And makes us all treat each other differently, too, if we're all connected to one another. You know, Andrew, it has been a fantastic conversation. I'm so sorry for Carl's daughter, but we will have him back. But I'm glad we had the full 2 hours to fully explore these ideas. 1 hour certainly would not have been enough because we could certainly go on. And I will invite you back anytime to continue the conversation.
Well, that's good to hear. I have thoroughly enjoyed this, Karen, and I hope your listeners have too. And I would be absolutely delighted to come back at any time.
Well, thank you. I will be emailing you to, you know, get some referrals for some of these other scholars you think might be great for the show. But I just want to thank you so very much for doing the work out there. I can't help but feel somewhere inside me, Andrew, that people like us who are talking these new ideas, who are trying to bring back this ancient wisdom, you know, I can't help but think that we are going to be the teachers of tomorrow. You know, I hope so anyway. Either that or we're planting the seeds for the teachers of tomorrow. You know, I just hope we live to see the shift, you know, the real shift toward, you know, the feminine really at the center of our cultures, you know, rather on the fringes like she is now. But I think she's gaining ground. I really do.
She is awakening, right? And we every day hear that pulse a little more.
And more people from all different walks of life, from all different corners of the globe, are beating the drum. You know, or they have this mantra. So I, you know, who knows what 10 years from now things may be different. That's the hope I hold.
And boy, I'm really, I know we're about out of time, but I am sure hopeful for the kinds of things I'm seeing in India and Egypt and a few other places where we have women in these societies who historically had no voice whatsoever really starting to step forward and say enough is enough.
Absolutely.
We have to stop this. And so that, I think, building a global movement of men and women focused around the same idea is really where our power is going to come, is we can stop this sort of nationalism that keeps us so separate and really work together on this idea.
Absolutely. Well, Andrew, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for your work out there in the world. Let's most definitely keep in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you, Karen.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, I'm sure you had as much fun as I had tonight, and there's no more time left for bees in my bonnet or music or anything else like that, but you know what? That is perfectly okay because the conversation has been rich and wonderful. So please tune in next week. I'm going to have Normandy Ellis talking about dream temples in Egypt and Bob Koenig talking about the goddess Hera. We've never spoken about Hera on the show yet. We will talk about her next week. So that's what I have in store for you next Wednesday. So please, have a wonderful week, and remember, stay connected, and may Goddess embrace you and her golden wings. Good night.